Side 5, The Caves of Steel, by Isaac Asimov. Continuing on page 180. "It's empty," he said blankly. "There is no charge in it," agreed Ardenil. "If you will look closer, you will see that there has never been a charge in it. The blaster has no ignition bud and cannot be used." Bailey said, "You held an uncharged blaster on the crowd?" "I had to have a blaster or fail in my role as plainclothesman," said Ardenil. "Yet to carry a charged and usable blaster might have made it possible for me to hurt a human being by accident, a thing which is, of course, unthinkable. I would have explained this at the time, but you were angry and would not listen." Bailey stared bleakly at the useless blaster in his hand and said in a low voice, "I think that's all, Dr. Garrigle. Thank you for helping out." Bailey sent out for lunch, but when it came, yeast nut cake and a rather extravagant slice of fried chicken on cracker, he could only stare at it. Round and round went the currents of his mind. The lines of his long face were etched in deep gloom. He was living in an unreal world, a cruel, topsy-turvy world. How had it happened? The immediate past stretched behind him like a misty, improbable dream, dating back to the moment he had stepped into Julius Enderby's office, and found himself suddenly immersed in a nightmare of murder and robotics. Jehoshaphat. It had begun only 50 hours before. Persistently, he had sought the solution in Spacetown. Twice he had accused Ardenil, once as a human being in disguise, and once as an admitted and actual robot, each time as a murderer. Twice the accusation had been bent back and broken. He was being driven back. Against his will, he was forced to turn his thoughts into the city. And since last night, he dared not. Certain questions battered at his conscious mind. But he would not listen. He felt he could not. If he heard them, he couldn't help but answer them, and, oh God, he didn't want to face the answers. "Lige! Lige!" A hand shook Bailey's shoulder roughly. Bailey stirred and said, "What's up, Phil?" Philip Norris, plainclothesman C5, sat down, put his hands on his knees, and leaned forward, peering at Bailey's face. "What happened to you? Been living on knockout drops lately? You were sitting there with your eyes open, and near as I could make out, you were dead." He rubbed his thinning, pale blonde hair, and his close-set eyes appraised Bailey's cooling lunch greedily. "Chicken," he said. "It's getting so you can't get it without a doctor's prescription." "Take some," said Bailey listlessly. Decorum won out, and Norris said, "Oh, well, I'm going out to eat in a minute. You keep it. Say, what's doing with the commish?" "What?" Norris attempted a casual attitude, but his hands were restless. He said, "Go on, you know what I mean. You've been living with him ever since he got back. What's up? A promotion in the works?" Bailey frowned and felt reality return somewhat at the touch of office politics. Norris had approximately his own seniority, and he was bound to watch most assiduously for any sign of official preference in Bailey's direction. Bailey said, "No promotion, believe me. It's nothing. Nothing. And if it's the commissioner you're wanting, I wish I could give him to you. Jehoshaphat, take him." Norris said, "Don't get me wrong. I don't care if you get promoted. I just mean that if you've got any pull with the commish, how about using it for the kid?" "What kid?" There was no need of any answer to that. Vincent Barrett, the youngster who had been moved out of his job to make room for Arsami, was shuffling up from an unnoticed corner of the room. A skull cap turned restlessly in his hands, and the skin over his high cheekbones moved as he tried to smile. "Hello, Mr. Bailey." "Oh, hello, Vince. How are you doing?" "Not so good, Mr. Bailey." He was looking about hungrily. Bailey thought, he looks lost, half dead, declassified. Then savagely, his lips almost moving with the force of his emotion, he thought, "But what does he want from me?" He said, "I'm sorry, kid." What else was there to say? "I keep thinking, maybe something is turned up." Norris moved in close and spoke into Bailey's ear. someone's got to stop this sort of thing. They're going to move out Chen Lo now. What? Haven't you heard? No, I haven't. Damn it! He's a C3. He's got 10 years behind him. I grant that. But a machine with legs can do his work. Who's next? Young Vince Barrett was oblivious to the whispers. He said out of the depths of his own thinking, Mr. Bailey? Yes, Vince? You know what they say? They say Lyraine Mullane, the subetherics dancer, is really a robot. That's silly. Is it? They say they can make robots look just like humans, with a special plastic skin, sort of. Bailey thought guiltily of Ardenil and found no words. He shook his head. The boy said, Do you suppose anyone will mind if I just walk around? It makes me feel better to see the old place. Go ahead, kid. The youngster wandered off. Bailey and Norris watched him go. Norris said, It looks as though the medievalists are right. You mean back to the soil? Is that it, Phil? No! I mean about the robots. Back to the soil, huh? Old Earth has an unlimited future. We don't need robots, that's all. Bailey muttered, 8 billion people and the uranium running out. What's unlimited about it? What if the uranium does run out? We'll import it. Or we'll discover other nuclear processes. There's no way you can stop mankind, Lige. You've got to be optimistic about it and have faith in the old human brain. Our greatest resource is ingenuity. And we'll never run out of that, Lige. He was fairly started now. He went on. For one thing, we can use sun power, and that's good for billions of years. We can build space stations inside Mercury's orbit to act as energy accumulators. We'll transmit energy to Earth by direct beam. This project was not new to Bailey. The speculative fringe of science had been playing with the notion for 150 years at least. What was holding it up was the impossibility so far of projecting a beam tight enough to reach 50 million miles without dispersal to uselessness. Bailey said as much. Norris said, When it's necessary, it'll be done. Why worry? Bailey had the picture of an Earth of unlimited energy. Population could continue to increase. The yeast farms could expand. Hydroponic culture intensify. Energy was the only thing indispensable. The raw minerals could be brought in from the uninhabited rocks of the system. If ever water became a bottleneck, more could be brought in from the moons of Jupiter. Hell, the oceans could be frozen and dragged out into space, where they could circle Earth as moonlets of ice. There they would be, always available for use, while the ocean bottoms would represent more land for exploitation, more room to live. Even carbon and oxygen could be maintained and increased on Earth through utilization of the methane atmosphere of Titan and the frozen oxygen of Umbriel. Earth's population could reach 1 trillion or 2. Why not? There was a time when the current population of 8 billion would have been viewed as impossible. There was a time when a population of 1 billion would have been unthinkable. There had always been prophets of Malthusian doom in every generation since medieval times, and they had always proven wrong. But what would Fastolf say? A world of 1 trillion? Surely. But they would be dependent on imported air and water and upon an energy supply from complicated storehouses 50 million miles away. How incredibly unstable that would be. Earth would be and remain a feather's weight away from complete catastrophe at the slightest failure of any part of the system-wide mechanism. Bailey said, I think it would be easier to ship off some of the surplus population myself. It was more an answer to the picture he had himself conjured up than to anything Norris had said. Who'd have us? Said Norris with a bitter lightness. Any uninhabited planet. Norris rose, patted Bailey on the shoulder. Lige, you eat your chicken and recover. You must be living on knockout pills. He left, chuckling. Bailey watched him leave with a humorless twist to his mouth. Norris would spread the news, and it would be weeks before the humor boys of the office, every office has them, would lay off. But at least it got him off the subject of young Vince, robots, or declassification. He sighed as he put a fork into the now cold and somewhat stringy chicken. Bailey finished the last of the yeast nut, and it was only then that R. Daniel left his own desk, a sign him that morning, and approached. Bailey eyed him uncomfortably. Well? R. Daniel said, the commissioner is not in his office, and it is not known when he'll be back. I've told R. Sammy we will use it, and that he is to allow no one but the commissioner to enter. What are we going to use it for? Greater privacy. Surely you agree that we must plan our next move. After all, you do not intend to abandon the investigation, do you? That was precisely what Bailey most longed to do. But obviously, he could not say so. He rose and led the way to Enderby's office. Once in the office, Bailey said, all right, Daniil, what is it? The robot said, partner Elijah, since last night, you are not yourself. There is a definite alteration in your mental aura. A horrible thought sprang full-grown into Bailey's mind. He cried, are you telepathic? It was not a possibility he would have considered at a less disturbed moment. No, of course not, said R. Daniil. Bailey's panic ebbed. He said, then what the devil do you mean by talking about my mental aura? It is merely an expression I use to describe a sensation that you do not share with me. What sensation? It is difficult to explain, Elijah. You will recall that I was originally designed to study human psychology for our people back in Spacetown. Yes, I know. You were adjusted to detective work by the simple installation of a justice desire circuit. Bailey did not try to keep the sarcasm out of his voice. Exactly, Elijah. But my original design remains essentially unaltered. I was constructed for the purpose of cerebroanalysis. For analyzing brainwaves? Why, yes. It can be done by field measurements without the necessity of direct electrode contact, if the proper receiver exists. My mind is such a receiver. Is that principle not applied on Earth? Bailey didn't know. He ignored the question and said cautiously, if you measure the brainwaves, what do you get out of it? Not thoughts, Elijah. I get a glimpse of emotion, and most of all, I can analyze temperament, the underlying drives and attitudes of a man. For instance, it was I who was able to ascertain that Commissioner Enderby was incapable of killing a man under the circumstances prevailing at the time of the murder. And they eliminate him as a suspect on your say-so? Yes. It was safe enough to do so. I am a very delicate machine in that respect. Again, a thought struck Bailey. Wait. Commissioner Enderby didn't know he was being cerebroanalyzed, did he? There was no necessity of hurting his feelings. I mean, you just stood there and looked at him. No machinery, no electrodes, no needles and graphs. Certainly not. I am a self-contained unit. Bailey bit his lower lip in anger and chagrin. It had been the one remaining inconsistency, the one loophole through which a forlorn stab might yet be made in an attempt to pin the crime on Spacetown. R. Daniel had stated that the commissioner had been cerebroanalyzed, and 1 hour later, the commissioner himself had, with apparent candor, denied any knowledge of the term. Certainly no man could have undergone the shattering experience of electroencephalographic measurements by electrode and graph under the suspicion of murder, without an unmistakable impression of what cerebroanalysis must be. But now that discrepancy had evaporated. The commissioner had been cerebroanalyzed, and had never known it. R. Daniil told the truth. So had the commissioner. Well, said Bailey sharply, what does cerebroanalysis tell you about me? You are disturbed. That's a great discovery, isn't it? Of course I'm disturbed. Specifically, though, your disturbance is due to a clash between motivations within you. On the one hand, your devotion to the principles of your profession urges you to look deeply into this conspiracy of Earthmen who lay siege to us last night. Another motivation, equally strong, forces you in the opposite direction. This much is clearly written in the electric field on your cerebral cells. My cerebral cells nuts! Said Bailey feverishly. Look, I'll tell you why there's no point in investigating your so-called conspiracy. It has nothing to do with the murder. I thought it might have. I'll admit that. Yesterday in the kitchen, I thought we were in danger. But what happened? They followed us out, were quickly lost on the strips, and that was that. That was not the action of well-organized and desperate men. My own son found out where we were staying easily enough. He called the department. He didn't even have to identify himself. Our precious conspirators could have done the same if they had really wanted to hurt us. Didn't they? Obviously not. If they had wanted riots, they could have started one at the shoe counter. And yet they backed out tamely enough before one man and a blaster. One robot and a blaster, which they must have known you would be unable to fire once they recognized what you were. They're medievalists. They're harmless crackpots. You wouldn't know that, but I should have. And I would have, if it weren't for the fact that this whole business has me thinking in foolish, melodramatic terms. I tell you, I know the type of people that become medievalists. They're soft, dreamy people who find life too hard for them here and get lost in an ideal world of the past that never really existed. If you could cerebro-analyze a movement as you do an individual, you would find they are no more capable of murder than Julius Enderby himself. R. Daniil said slowly, I cannot accept your statements at face value. What do you mean? Your conversion to this view is too sudden. There are certain discrepancies, too. You arranged the appointment with Dr. Garrigal hours before the evening meal. You did not know of my food sack then, and could not have suspected me as the murderer. Why did you call him then? I suspected you even then. And last night you spoke as you slept. Bailey's eyes widened. What did I say? Merely the one word, Jesse, several times repeated. I believe you were referring to your wife. Bailey let his tight muscles loosen. He said shakily, I had a nightmare. Do you know what it is? I do not know by personal experience, of course. The dictionary definition has it that it is a bad dream. And do you know what a dream is? Again, the dictionary definition only. It is an illusion of reality experienced during the temporary suspension of conscious thought, which you call sleep. All right, I'll buy that. An illusion. Sometimes the illusions can seem damned real. Well, I dreamed my wife was in danger. It's the sort of dream people often have. I called her name. That happens under such circumstances, too. You can take my word for it. I am only too glad to do so. But it brings up a thought. How did Jesse find out I was a robot? Bailey's forehead went moist again. We're not going into that again, are we? The rumor... I am sorry to interrupt, partner Elijah. But there is no rumor. If there were, the city would be alive with unrest today. I have checked reports coming into the department, and this is not so. There simply is no rumor. Therefore, how did your wife find out?
Jehoshaphat, what are you trying to say? Do you think my wife is one of the members of...
Yes, Elijah. Bailey gripped his hands together tightly.
Well, she isn't. And we won't discuss that point any further.
This is not like you, Elijah. In the course of duty, you accused me of murder twice.
And is this your way of getting even?
I am not sure I understand what you mean by the phrase. Certainly, I approve your readiness to suspect me. You had your reasons. They were wrong, but they might easily have been right. Equally strong evidence points to your wife.
As a murderess? Why, damn you, Jesse wouldn't hurt her worst enemy. She couldn't set foot outside the city. She couldn't... Why, if you were flesh and blood, I'd...
I merely say that she is a member of the conspiracy. I say that she should be questioned.
Not on your life! Not on whatever it is you call your life. Now listen to me. The medievalists aren't after our blood. It's not the way they do things. But they are trying to get you out of the city. That much is obvious. And they're trying to do it by a kind of psychological attack. They're trying to make life unpleasant for you and for me, since I'm with you. They could easily have found out Jesse was my wife. And it was an obvious move for them to let the news leak to her. She's like any other human being. She doesn't like robots. She wouldn't want me to associate with one, especially if she thought it involved danger, and surely they would imply that. I tell you, it worked. She begged all night to have me abandon the case or to get you out of the city somehow.
Presumably, said Ardenil, you have a very strong urge to protect your wife against questioning. It seems obvious to me that you are constructing this line of argument without really believing it.
What the hell do you think you are? Ground out Bailey. You're not a detective. You're a cerebroanalysis machine, like the electroencephalographs we have in this building. You've got arms, legs, a head, and can't talk, but you're not one inch more than a machine. Putting a lousy circuit into you doesn't make you a detective, so what do you know? You keep your mouth shut and let me do the figuring out.
The robot said quietly, I think it would be better if you lowered your voice, Elijah. Granted that I am not a detective in the sense that you are, I would still like to bring one small item to your attention.
I'm not interested in listening.
Please do. If I am wrong, you will tell me so, and it will do no harm. It is only this. Last night, you left our room to call Jesse by corridor phone. I suggested that your son go in your place. You told me it was not the custom among Earthmen for a father to send his son into danger.
Is it then the custom for a mother to do so? No, of course,
began Bailey, and stopped. You see my point, said Ardenil. Ordinarily, if Jessie feared for your safety and wished to warn you, she would risk her own life, not send her son. The fact that she did send Bentley could only mean that she felt that he would be safe, while she herself would not. If the conspiracy consisted of people unknown to Jesse, that would not be the case. Or at least, she would have no reason to think it to be the case. On the other hand, if she were a member of the conspiracy, she would know. She would know, Elijah, that she would be watched for and recognized, whereas Bentley might get through unnoticed.
Wait now, said Bailey, sick at heart. That's feather fine reasoning, but...
There was no need to wait. The signal on the commissioner's desk was flickering madly. Ardenil waited for Bailey to answer, but the latter could only stare at it helplessly. The robot closed contact.
What is it?
R. Sammy's slurring voice said, There is a lady here who wishes to see Lige. I told her he was busy, but she will not go away. She says her name is Jessie.
Let her in, said Ardenil calmly, and his brown eyes rose unemotionally to meet the panicky glare of Bailey's.
14. Power of a name. Bailey remained standing in a tetany of shock, as Jessie ran to him, seizing his shoulders, huddling close. His pale lips formed the word, Bentley? She looked at him and shook her head, her brown hair flying with the force of her motion.
He's all right.
Well, then? Jessie said through a sudden torrent of sobs, in a low voice that could scarcely be made out,
I can't go on, Lige. I can't. I can't sleep or eat. I've got to tell you.
Don't say anything, Bailey said in anguish.
For God's sake, Jessie, not now. I must. I've done a terrible thing. Such a terrible thing. Oh, Lige!
She lapsed into incoherence.
Bailey said hopelessly, We're not alone, Jessie.
She looked up and stared at Ardenil with no signs of recognition. The tears in which her eyes were swimming might easily be refracting the robot into a featureless blur. Ardenil said in a low murmur, Good afternoon, Jessie. She gasped.
Is it the robot?
She dashed the back of her hand across her eyes and stepped out of Bailey's encircling right arm. She breathed deeply, and for a moment, a tremulous smile wavered on her lips.
It is you, isn't it?
Yes, Jessie.
You don't mind being called a robot?
No, Jessie. It is what I am.
And I don't mind being called a fool and an idiot and a subversive agent, because it's what I am. Jessie,
groaned Bailey. It's no use, Lige, she said. He might as well know if he's your partner. I can't live with it anymore. I've had such a time since yesterday. I don't care if I go to jail. I don't care if they send me down to the lowest levels and make me live on raw yeast and water. I don't care if... You won't let them, will you, Lige? Don't let them do anything to me. I'm frightened. Bailey patted her shoulder and let her cry. He said to our Daniil, she isn't well. We can't keep her here. What time is it? R. Daniil said without any visible signs of consulting a timepiece, 14:45.
The commissioner could be back any minute. Look, commandeer a squad car and we can talk about this in the motorway.
Jesse's head jerked upright.
The motorway? Oh, no, Lige!
He said, in as soothing a tone as he could manage, Now, Jesse, don't be superstitious. You can't go on the expressway the way you are. Be a good girl and calm down. Oh, you won't even be able to go through the common room. I'll get you some water.
She wiped her face with a damp handkerchief and said drearily, Oh, look at my makeup.
Don't worry about your makeup, said Bailey. Daniil, what about the squad car?
It's waiting for us now, partner Elijah.
Come on, Jesse.
Wait. Wait just a minute, Lige. I've got to do something to my face.
It doesn't matter now.
But she twisted away. Please, I can't go to the common room like this. I won't take a second.
The man and the robot waited, the man with little jerky clenchings of his fists, the robot impassively. Jesse rummaged through a purse for the necessary equipment. If there were one thing, Bailey had once said solemnly, that had resisted mechanical improvement since medieval times, it was a woman's purse. Even the substitution of magnetic clutches for metal clasps had not proven successful. Jesse pulled out a small mirror and the silver-chased Cosmeto kit that Bailey had bought her on the occasion of 3 birthdays before. The Cosmeto kit had several orifices, and she used each in turn. All but the last spray were invisible. She used them with that fineness of touch and delicacy of control that seems to be the birthright of women, even at times of the greatest stress. The base went on first in a smooth, even layer that removed all shininess and roughness from the skin and left it with the faintly golden glow which long experience had taught Jessie was just the shade most suited to the natural coloring of her hair and eyes. Then the touch of tan along the forehead and chin, a gentle brush of rouge on either cheek, tracing back to the angle of the jaw, and a delicate drift of blue on the upper eyelids and along the earlobes. Finally, there was the application of the smooth carmine to the lips. That involved the one visible spray, a faintly pink mist that glistened liquidly in air, but dried and deepened richly on contact with the lips. There, said Jesse, with several swift pats at her hair and a look of deep satisfaction. I suppose that will do. The process had taken more than the promised second, but less than 15 seconds. Nevertheless, it had seemed interminable to Bailey. Come, he said. She barely had time to return the Cosmeto kit to the purse before he had pushed her through the door. The eerie silence of the motorway lay thick on either side. Bailey said, All right, Jesse. The impassivity that had covered Jesse's face since they first left the commissioner's office showed signs of cracking. She looked at her husband and at Daniil with a helpless silence. Bailey said, Get it over with, Jesse, please. Have you committed a crime, an actual crime?
A crime?
She shook her head uncertainly. Now, hold on to yourself. No hysterics. Just say yes or no, Jesse. Have you? He hesitated a trifle. Killed anyone? The look on Jesse's face was promptly transmitted to indignation.
Why, Lige Bailey!
Yes or no, Jesse?
No, of course not.
The hard knot in Bailey's stomach softened perceptibly. Have you stolen anything? Falsified ration data? Assaulted anyone? Destroyed property? Speak up, Jesse.
I haven't done anything. Anything specific? I didn't mean anything like that.
She looked over his shoulder.
Lige, do we have to stay down here?
Right here until this is over. Now, start at the beginning. What did you come to tell us? Over Jesse's bowed head, Bailey's eyes met R. Daniil's. Jesse spoke in a soft voice that gained in strength and articulateness as she went on.
It's these people, these medievalists. You know, Lige, they're always around, always talking. Even in the old days, when I was an assistant dietitian, it was like that. Remember Elizabeth Thornbow? She was a medievalist. She was always talking about how all our troubles came from the city, and how things were better before the cities started.
I used to ask her how she was so sure that was so, especially after you and I met, Lige.
Remember the talks we used to have? And then she would quote from those small book reels that are always floating around, you know, like Shame of the Cities, that the fellow wrote. I don't remember his name.
Bailey said absently, Agrinsky.
Yes, only most of them were lots worse. Then, when I married you, she was really sarcastic. She said, I suppose you're going to be a real city woman now that you've married a policeman.
After that, she didn't talk to me much, and then I quit the job, and that was that.
Lots of things she used to say were just to shock me, I think, or to make herself look mysterious and glamorous.
She was an old maid, you know. Never got married till the day she died. Lots of those medievalists don't fit in, one way or another.
Remember, you once said, Lige, that people sometimes mistake their own shortcomings for those of society and want to fix the cities because they don't know how to fix themselves?
Bailey remembered, and his words now sounded flip and superficial in his own ears. He said gently, Keep to the point, Jesse. She went on. Anyway, Lizzie was always talking about how there'd come a day and people had to get together. She said it was all the fault of the spacers because they wanted to keep Earth weak and decadent. That was one of her favorite words. Decadent. She'd look at the menus I'd prepare for the next week and sniff and say, Decadent. Decadent. Jane Myers used to imitate her in the cookroom, and we'd die laughing. She said, Elizabeth did, that someday we were going to break up the cities and go back to the soil and have an accounting with the spacers, who were trying to tie us forever to the cities by forcing robots on us. Only she never called them robots. She used to say, soulless monster machines, if you'll excuse the expression, Daniil. The robot said, I am not aware of the significance of the adjective you used, Jesse. But in any case, the expression is excused. Please go on. Bailey stirred restlessly. It was that way with Jesse. No emergency, no crisis could make her tell a story in any way but her own circuitous one. She said, Elizabeth always tried to talk as though there were lots of people in it with her. She would say, at the last meeting, and then stop and look at me, sort of half proud and half scared, as though she wanted me to ask about it so she could look important. And yet scared I might get her in trouble. Of course, I never asked her. I wouldn't give her the satisfaction. Anyway, after I married you, Lige, it was all over until... She stopped. Go on, Jesse, said Bailey.
You remember, Lige, that argument we had? About Jezebel, I mean?
What about it? It took a second or two for Bailey to remember that it was Jesse's own name, and not a reference to another woman. He turned to R. Daniil in an automatically defensive explanation. Jesse's full name is Jezebel. She is not fond of it and doesn't use it. R. Daniil nodded gravely, and Bailey thought, Jehoshaphat, why waste worry on him?
It bothered me a lot, Lige, Jesse said. It really did. I guess it was silly, but I kept thinking and thinking about what you said. I mean about your saying that Jezebel was only a conservative who fought for the ways of her ancestors against the strange ways the newcomers had brought. After all, I was Jezebel, and I always...
She groped for a word, and Bailey supplied it. Identified yourself?
Yes.
But she shook her head almost immediately and looked away. Not really, of course, not literally.
The way I thought she was, you know.
I wasn't like that.
I know that, Jesse. Don't be foolish. But still I thought of her a lot, and somehow I got to thinking. It's just the same now as it was then. I mean, we Earth people had our old ways, and here were the spacers coming in with a lot of new ways, and trying to encourage the new ways we had stumbled into ourselves, and maybe the medievalists were right. Maybe we should go back to our old, good ways. So I went back and found Elizabeth.
Yes, go on.
She said she didn't know what I was talking about, and besides, I was a cop's wife. I said that had nothing to do with it, and finally she said, well, she'd speak to somebody, and then about a month later, she came to me and said it was all right, and I joined, and I've been at meetings ever since.
Bailey looked at her sadly. And you never told me? Jesse's voice trembled.
I'm sorry, Lige.
Well, that won't help. Being sorry, I mean. I want to know about the meetings. In the first place, where were they held?
A sense of detachment was creeping over him, a numbing of emotions. What he had tried not to believe was so, was openly so, was unmistakably so. In a sense, it was a relief to have the uncertainty over. She said,
down here?
Down here? You mean on this spot? What do you mean?
Here, in the motorway. That's why I didn't want to come down here. It was a wonderful place to meet, though. We'd get together.
How many?
I'm not sure. About 60 or 70. It was just a sort of local branch. There'd be folding chairs and some refreshments, and someone would make a speech, mostly about how wonderful life was in the old days, and how someday we'd do away with the monsters, the robots, that is, and the spacers, too. The speeches were sort of dull, really, because they were all the same. We just endured them. Mostly it was the fun of getting together and feeling important. We would pledge ourselves to oaths, and there'd be secret ways we would greet each other on the outside.
Weren't you ever interrupted? No squad cars or fire engines passed?
No, never.
R. Daniel interrupted. Is that unusual, Elijah?
Maybe not,
Bailey answered thoughtfully. There are some side passages that are practically never used. It's quite a trick, knowing which they are, though.
Is that all you did at the meetings, Jesse? Make speeches and play at conspiracy?
It's about all. And sing songs, sometimes. And, of course, refreshments. Not much. Sandwiches, usually, and juice.
In that case, he said almost brutally, what's bothering you now?
Jesse winced.
You're angry.
Please, said Bailey with iron patience, answer my question. If it were all as harmless as that, why have you been in such a panic for the last day and a half?
I thought they would hurt you, Lige. For heaven's sake, why do you act as though you don't understand? I've explained it to you.
No, you haven't, not yet. You've told me about a harmless little secret coffee clot you belonged to. Did they ever hold open demonstrations? Did they ever destroy robots, start riots, kill people?
Never, Lige. I wouldn't do any of those things. I wouldn't stay a member if they tried it.
Well then, why do you say you've done a terrible thing? Why do you expect to be sent to jail?
Well, they used to talk about someday when they'd put pressure on the government. We were supposed to get organized, and then afterward there would be huge strikes and work stoppages. We could force the government to ban all robots and make the spacers go back where they came from. I thought it was just talk, and then this thing started. About you and Daniil, I mean. Then they said, now we'll see action, and we're going to make an example of them and put a stop to the robot invasion right now. Right there in personal, they said it, not knowing it was you they were talking about. But I knew right away.
Her voice broke. Bailey softened. Come on, Jesse.
It was all nothing. It was just talk. You can see for yourself that nothing has happened. I was so scared. And I thought, I'm part of it. If there are going to be killing and destruction, you might be killed and Bentley, and somehow it would be all my fault for taking part in it. And I ought to be sent to jail.
Bailey let her sob herself out. He put his arm about her shoulder and stared tight-lipped at R. Daniil, who gazed calmly back. He said, now, I want you to think, Jesse, who was the head of your group? She was quieter now, patting the corners of her eyes with a handkerchief.
A man called Joseph Clemen was the leader, but he wasn't really anybody. He wasn't more than 5 feet 4 inches tall, and I think he was terribly henpecked at home. I don't think there's any harm in him. You aren't going to arrest him, are you, Lige? On my say-so?
She looked guiltily troubled. I'm not arresting anyone just yet. How did Clement get his instructions?
I don't know.
Did any strangers come to meetings? You know what I mean. Big shots from central headquarters.
Sometimes people would come to make speeches. That wasn't very often, maybe twice a year or so.
Can you name them?
No. They were always just introduced as one of us, or a friend from Jackson Heights, or wherever.
I see. Daniil?
Yes, Elijah, said R. Daniil.
Describe the man you think you've tabbed. We'll see if Jesse can recognize them. R. Daniil went through the list with clinical exactness. Jesse listened with an expression of dismay as the categories of physical measurements lengthened and shook her head with increasing firmness.
It's no use, it's no use, she cried. How can I remember? I can't remember how any of them looked. I can't.
She stopped and seemed to consider. Then she said,
Did you say one of them was a yeast farmer?
Francis Clusar, said R. Daniil, is an employee at New York Yeast.
Well, you know, once a man was making a speech and I happened to be sitting in the first row and I kept getting a whiff, just a whiff, really, of raw yeast smell. You know what I mean. The only reason that I remember is that I had an upset stomach that day and the smell kept making me sick. I had to stand up and move to the back, and of course I couldn't explain what was wrong. It was so embarrassing. Maybe that's the man you're speaking of. After all, when you work with yeast all the time, the odor gets to stick to your clothes.
She wrinkled her nose.
You don't remember what he looked like? Said Bailey.
No, she replied, with decision.
All right, then. Look, Jesse, I'm going to take you to your mother's. Bentley will stay with you, and none of you will leave the section. Ben can stay away from school, and I'll arrange to have meals sent in and the corridors around the apartment watched by the police.
What about you?
Quavered Jesse.
I'll be in no danger.
But how long?
I don't know. Maybe just a day or two. The words sounded hollow even to himself. They were back in the motorway, Bailey and R. Daniil alone now. Bailey's expression was dark with thought.
It would seem to me, he said, that we are faced with an organization built up on two levels. First, a ground level with no specific program, designed only to supply mass support for an eventual coup. Secondly, a much smaller elite we must find. The comic opera groups that Jesse spoke of can be ignored.
All this, said R. Daniil, follows, perhaps, if we can take Jesse's story at face value.
I think, Bailey said stiffly, that Jesse's story can be accepted as completely true.
So it would seem, said R. Daniil. There is nothing about her cerebro impulses that would indicate a pathological addiction to lying.
Bailey turned an offended look upon the robot. I should say not. And there will be no necessity to mention her name in our reports. Do you understand that?
If you wish it so, partner Elijah, said R. Daniil calmly, but our report will then be neither complete nor accurate.
Bailey said, Well, maybe so, but no real harm will be done. She has come to us with whatever information she had, and to mention her name will only put her in the police records. I do not want that to happen.
In that case, certainly not, provided we are certain that nothing more remains to be found out.
Nothing remains as far as she's concerned. My guarantee.
Could you then explain why the word Jezebel, the mere sound of a name, should lead her to abandon previous convictions and assume a new set? The motivation seems obscure.
They were traveling slowly through the curving empty tunnel.
Bailey said, It is hard to explain. Jezebel is a rare name. It belonged once to a woman of very bad reputation. My wife treasured that fact. It gave her a vicarious feeling of wickedness and compensated for a life that was uniformly proper.
Why should a law-abiding woman wish to feel wicked?
Bailey almost smiled.
Women are women, Daniil. Anyway, I did a very foolish thing.
In a moment of irritation, I insisted that the historic Jezebel was not particularly wicked and was, if anything, a good wife. I've regretted that ever since. It turned out, he went on, that I had made Jessie bitterly unhappy. I had spoiled something for her that couldn't be replaced. I suppose what followed was her way of revenge. I imagine she wished to punish me by engaging in activity of which she knew I wouldn't approve. I don't say the wish was a conscious one.
Can a wish be anything but conscious? Is that not a contradiction in terms?
Bailey stared at R. Daniel and despaired of attempting to explain the unconscious mind. He said instead, "Besides that, the Bible has a great influence on human thought and emotion."
What is the Bible?
For a moment, Bailey was surprised, and then was surprised at himself for having felt surprised. The Spacers, he knew, lived under a thoroughly mechanistic personal philosophy, and R. Daniel could know only what the Spacers knew, no more. He said curtly, "It is the sacred book of about half of Earth's population."
I do not grasp the meaning here of the adjective.
I mean that it is highly regarded. Various portions of it, when properly interpreted, contain a code of behavior which many men consider best suited to the ultimate happiness of mankind.
R. Daniel seemed to consider that. Is this code incorporated into your laws?
I'm afraid not. The code doesn't lend itself to legal enforcement. It must be obeyed spontaneously by each individual out of a longing to do so. It is, in a sense, higher than any law can be.
Higher than law? Is that not a contradiction in terms?
Bailey smiled wryly. Shall I quote a portion of the Bible for you? Would you be curious to hear it?
Please do.
Bailey let the car slow to a halt and for a few moments sat with his eyes closed, remembering. He would have liked to use the sonorous Middle English of the medieval Bible, but to R. Daniel, Middle English would be gibberish. He began speaking almost casually in the words of the modern revision, as though he were telling a story of contemporary life instead of dredging a tale out of man's dimmest past. Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, and at dawn returned to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and preached to them. And the scribes and Pharisees brought to him a woman caught in adultery. And when they had placed her before him, they said to him, "Master, this woman was caught in adultery, in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us to stone such offenders. What do you say?" They said this, hoping to trap him, that they might have grounds for accusations against him. But Jesus stooped down, and with his finger wrote on the ground, as though he had not heard them. But when they continued asking him, he stood up and said to them, "He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her." And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. And those that heard this, being convicted by their own conscience, went away one by one, beginning with the oldest down to the last. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. When Jesus stood up and saw no one but the woman, he said to her, "Woman, where are your accusers? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said to her, "Nor do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." R. Daniel listened attentively. He said, "What is adultery?" "That doesn't matter. It was a crime, and at the time, the accepted punishment was stoning. That is, stones were thrown at the guilty one until she was killed."
"And the woman was guilty?"
"She was."
"Then why was she not stoned?"
None of the accusers felt he could after Jesus' statement. The story is meant to show that there is something even higher than the justice which you have been filled with. There is a human impulse known as mercy, a human act known as forgiveness.
"I am not acquainted with those words, partner Elijah."
"I know," muttered Bailey. "I know." He started the squad car with a jerk and let it tear forward savagely. He was pressed back against the cushions of the seat. Where are we going? Asked Ardenil. To Yeasttown, said Bailey, to get the truth out of Francis Clusar, conspirator. You have a method for doing this, Elijah?
Not I exactly. But you have, Daniil. A simple one.
They sped onward.
15. Arrest of a conspirator. Bailey could sense the vague aroma of Yeasttown growing stronger, more pervasive. He did not find it as unpleasant as some did. Jesse, for instance. He even liked it, rather. It had pleasant connotations. Every time he smelled raw yeast, the alchemy of sense perception threw him more than 3 decades into the past. He was a 10-year-old again, visiting his Uncle Boris, who was a yeast farmer. Uncle Boris always had a little supply of yeast delectables. Small cookies, chocolatey things filled with sweet liquid, hard confections in the shape of cats and dogs. Young as he was, he knew that Uncle Boris shouldn't really have had them to give away, and he always ate them very quietly, sitting in a corner with his back to the center of the room. He would eat them quickly for fear of being caught. They tasted all the better for that. Poor Uncle Boris. He had an accident and died. They never told him exactly how, and he had cried bitterly because he thought Uncle Boris had been arrested for smuggling yeast out of the plant. He expected to be arrested and executed himself. Years later, he poked carefully through police files and found the truth. Uncle Boris had fallen beneath the treads of a transport. It was a disillusioning ending to a romantic myth. Yet the myth would always arise in his mind, at least momentarily, at the whiff of raw yeast. Yeasttown was not the official name of any part of New York City. It could be found in no gazetteer and on no official map. What was called Yeasttown in popular speech was, to the post office, merely the boroughs of Newark, New Brunswick, and Trenton. It was a broad strip across what was once medieval New Jersey, dotted with residential areas, particularly in Newark Center and Trenton Center, but given over mostly to the many layered farms in which 1,000 varieties of yeast grew and multiplied. 1/5 of the city's population worked in the yeast farms. Another 1/5 worked in the subsidiary industries, beginning with the mountains of wood and coarse cellulose that were dragged into the city from the tangled forests of the Alleghenies, through the vats of acid that hydrolyzed it to glucose, the carloads of nitre and phosphate rock that were the most important additives, down to the jars of organics supplied by the chemical laboratories. It all came to one thing: yeast and more yeast. Without yeast, 6 of Earth's 8 billions would starve in a year. Bailey felt cold at the thought. 3 days before, the possibility existed as deeply as it did now. But 3 days before, it would never have occurred to him. They whizzed out of the motorway through an exit on the Newark outskirts. The thinly populated avenues, flanked on either side by the featureless blocks that were the farms, offered little to act as a brake on their speed. What time is it, Daniil? Asked Bailey. 16:05, replied R. Daniil. Then he'll be at work, if he's on day shift. Bailey parked the squad car in a delivery recess and froze the controls. This is New York yeast, then, Elijah? Asked the robot. Part of it, said Bailey. They entered into a corridor flanked by a double row of offices. A receptionist at a bend in the corridor was instantly smiles. Whom do you wish to see? Bailey opened his wallet. Police. Is there a Francis Clusar working for New York East? The girl looked perturbed. I can check. She connected her switchboard through a line plainly marked personnel, and her lips moved slightly, though no sound could be heard. Bailey was no stranger to throat phones that translated the small movements of the larynx into words. He said, Speak up, please. Let me hear you. Her words became audible, but consisted only of, He says he's a policeman, sir. A dark, well-dressed man came out of a door. He had a thin mustache, and his hairline was beginning to retreat. He smiled whitely and said, I'm Prescott of personnel. What's the trouble, officer? Bailey stared at him coldly, and Prescott's smile grew strained. Prescott said, I just don't want to upset the workers. They're touchy about the police. Bailey said, Tough, isn't it? Is Clusar in the building now? Yes, officer. Let's have a rod, then.
And if he's gone when we get there, I'll be speaking to you again.
The other's smile was quite dead. He muttered,
I'll get you a rod, officer.
The guide rod was set for Department CG, Section 2. What that meant in factory terminology, Bailey didn't know. He didn't have to. The rod was an inconspicuous thing which could be palmed in the hand. Its tip warmed gently when lined up in the direction for which it was set, cooled quickly when turned away. The warmth increased as the final goal was approached. To an amateur, the guide rod was almost useless, with its quick little differences of heat content. But few city dwellers were amateurs at this particular game. One of the most popular and perennial of the games of childhood was hide-and-seek through the school-level corridors with the use of toy guide rods.
Hot or not, let hot spot spot. Hot spot guide rods are keen.
Bailey had found his way through hundreds of massive piles by guide rod, and he could follow the shortest course with one of them in his hands as though it had been mapped out for him. When he stepped into a large and brilliantly lit room after 10 minutes, the guide rod's tip was almost hot. Bailey said to the worker nearest the door,
Francis Clusar here?
The worker jerked his head. Bailey walked in the indicated direction. The odor of yeast was sharply penetrating, despite the laboring air pumps whose humming made a steady background noise. A man had risen at the other end of the room and was taking off an apron. He was of moderate height, his face deeply lined despite his comparative youth, and his hair just beginning to grizzle. He had large, knobby hands, which he wiped slowly on a Celtex towel.
I'm Francis Clusar, he said.
Bailey looked briefly at R. Daniil. The robot nodded.
Okay, said Bailey. Anywhere here we can talk?
Maybe, said Clusar slowly. But it's just about the end of my shift. How about tomorrow?
Lots of hours between now and tomorrow. Let's make it now.
Bailey opened his wallet and palmed it at the yeast farmer. But Clusar's hands did not waver in their somber wiping motions. He said coolly,
I don't know the system in the police department, but around here, you get tight eating hours with no leeway. I eat at 1700 to 1745, or I don't eat.
It's all right, said Bailey. I'll arrange to have your supper brought to you.
Well, well, said Clusar joylessly. Just like an aristocrat or a C-class copper. What's next? Private bath?
You just answer questions, Clusar, said Bailey, and save your big jokes for your girlfriend. Where can we talk?
If you want to talk, how about the balance room? Suit yourself about that. Me? I've got nothing to say.
Bailey thumbed Clusar into the balance room. It was square and antiseptically white, air-conditioned independently of the larger room, and more efficiently, and with its walls lined with delicate electronic balances, glassed off and manipulable by field forces only. Bailey had used cheaper models in his college days. One make, which he recognized, could weigh a mere billion atoms. Clusar said,
I don't expect anyone will be in here for a while.
Bailey grunted, then turned to Daniil and said,
Would you step out and have a meal sent up here? And if you don't mind, wait outside for it.
He watched R. Daniil leave, then said to Clusar, You're a chemist?
I'm a zymologist, if you don't mind.
What's the difference?
Clusar looked lost.
A chemist is a soup pusher, a stink operator. A zymologist is a man who helps keep a few billion people alive. I'm a yeast culture specialist.
All right, said Bailey.
But Clusar went on.
This laboratory keeps New York yeast going. There isn't one day, not one damned hour, that we haven't got cultures of every strain of yeast in the company growing in our kettles. We check and adjust the food factor requirements. We make sure it's breeding true. We twist the genetics, start the new strains and weed them out, sort out their properties and mold them again. When New Yorkers started getting strawberries out of season a couple of years back, those weren't strawberries, fella. Those were a special high-sugar yeast culture with true bread color and just a dash of flavor additive. It was developed right here in this room. 20 years ago, Saccharomyces oleae benedictae was just a scrub strain with a lousy taste of tallow and good for nothing.
It still tastes of tallow, but its fat content has been pushed up from 15% to 87%. If you use the expressway today, just remember that it's greased strictly with S.O. Benedicte strain AG7, developed right here in this room. So don't call me a chemist. I'm a zymologist.
Despite himself, Bailey retreated before the fierce pride of the other. He said abruptly, "Where were you last night between the hours of 18 and 20?
Klusar shrugged. "Walking. I like to take a little walk after dinner."
"You visit friends? Or a subetheric?"
"No, just walked."
Bailey's lips tightened. A visit to the subetherics would have involved a notch in Klusar's ration plaque. A meeting with a friend would have involved naming a man or woman and a cross-check.
"No one saw you then?"
"Maybe someone did. I don't know. Not that I know of, though."
"What about the night before last?"
"Same thing."
"You have no alibi then for either night?"
"If I had done anything criminal, officer, I'd have one. What do I need an alibi for?"
Bailey didn't answer. He consulted his little book. "You were up before the magistrate once, inciting a riot."
"All right. One of the R things pushed past me and I tripped him up. Is that inciting to riot?"
"The courts thought so. You were convicted and fined."
"That ends it, doesn't it? Or do you want to fine me again?"
"Night before last, there was a near riot at a shoe department in the Bronx. You were seen there."
"By whom?"
Bailey said, "It was at mealtime for you here. Did you eat the evening meal night before last?" Klusar hesitated, then shook his head.
"Upset stomach. Yeast gets you that way sometimes. Even an old-timer."
"Last night there was a near riot in Williamsburg, and you were seen there."
"By whom?"
"Do you deny you were present on both occasions?"
"You're not giving me anything to deny. Exactly where did these things happen, and who says he saw me?"
Bailey stared at the zymologist levelly. "I think you know exactly what I'm talking about. I think you're an important man in an unregistered medievalist organization."
"I can't stop you from thinking, officer. But thinking isn't evidence. Maybe you know that."
Klusar was grinning. "Maybe," said Bailey, his long face stony. "I can get a little truth out of you right now." Bailey stepped to the door of the balance room and opened it. He said to R. Daniil, who was waiting stolidly outside, "Has Klusar's evening meal arrived?"
"It is coming now, Elijah."
"Bring it in, will you, Daniil?" R. Daniil entered a moment later with a metal compartmented tray. "Put it down in front of Mr. Klusar, Daniil," said Bailey. He sat down on one of the stools lining the balance wall, legs crossed, one shoe swinging rhythmically. He watched Klusar edge stiffly away as R. Daniil placed the tray on a stool near the zymologist.
"Mr. Klusar," said Bailey, "I want to introduce you to my partner, Daniil Olivaw."
Daniil put out his hand and said, "How do you do, Francis?" Klusar said nothing. He made no move to grasp Daniil's extended hand. Daniil maintained his position, and Klusar began to redden. Bailey said softly,
"You are being rude, Mr. Klusar.
Are you too proud to shake hands with a policeman?" Klusar muttered,
"If you don't mind, I'm hungry."
He unfolded a pocket fork out of a clasp knife he took from his pocket and sat down, eyes bent on his meal. Bailey said, "Daniil, I think our friend is offended by your cold attitude. You are not angry with him, are you?"
"Not at all, Elijah," said R. Daniil.
"Then show that there are no hard feelings.
Put your arm about his shoulder."
"I will be glad to," said R. Daniil, and stepped forward. Klusar put down his fork.
"What is this? What's going on?"
R. Daniil, unruffled, put out his arm. Klusar swung backhanded, wildly knocking R. Daniil's arm to one side.
"Damn it! Don't touch me!"
He jumped up and away, the tray of food tipping and hitting the floor in a messy clatter. Bailey, hard-eyed, nodded curtly to Ardaniel, who thereupon continued a stolid advance toward the retreating zymologist. Bailey stepped in front of the door. Klusar yelled, "Keep that thing off me!"
"That's no way to speak," said Bailey with equanimity. "The man's my partner."
"You mean he's a damn robot?"
shrieked Klusar. "Get away from him, Daniil," said Bailey promptly.
R. Daniil stepped back and stood quietly against the door just behind Bailey. Klusar, panting harshly, fists clenched, faced Bailey. Bailey said,
"All right, smart boy, what makes you think Daniil's a robot?"
"Anyone can tell."
"We'll leave that to a judge. Meanwhile, I think we want you at headquarters, Klusar. We'd like to have you explain exactly how you knew Daniil was a robot. And lots more, mister, lots more."
"Daniil, step outside and get through to the commissioner. He'll be at his home by now. Tell him to come down to the office. Tell him I have a fellow who can't wait to be questioned." R. Daniil stepped out.
Bailey said, "What makes your wheels go round, Klusar?"
"I want a lawyer."
"You'll get one. Meanwhile, suppose you tell me what makes you medievalists tick."
Klusar looked away in a determined silence.
Bailey said, "Jehoshaphat, man, we know all about you and your organization. I'm not bluffing. Just tell me, for my own curiosity, what do you medievalists want?"
"Back to the soil,"
said Klusar in a stifled voice.
"That's simple, isn't it?"
"It's simple to say," said Bailey. "But it isn't simple to do. How is the soil going to feed 8 billions?
"Did I say back to the soil overnight, or in a year, or in 100 years? Step by step, Mr. Policeman. It doesn't matter how long it takes, but let's get started out of these caves we live in. Let's get out into the fresh air."
"Have you ever been out into the fresh air?"
Klusar squirmed.
"All right. So I'm ruined, too.
But the children aren't ruined yet.
They're babies being born continuously.
Get them out, for God's sake. Let them have space and open air and sun. If we've got to, we'll cut our population little by little, too.
Backward, in other words, to an impossible past." Bailey did not really know why he was arguing, except for the strange fever that was burning in his own veins.
"Back to the seed, to the egg, to the womb. Why not move forward? Don't cut Earth's population. Use it for export. Go back to the soil, but go back to the soil of other planets. Colonize."
Klusar laughed harshly.
"And make more outer worlds, more spacers."
"We won't. The outer worlds were settled by Earthmen who came from a planet that did not have cities. By Earthmen who were individualists and materialists. Those qualities were carried to an unhealthy extreme. We can now colonize out of a society that has built cooperation, if anything, too far. Now environment and tradition can interact to form a new middle way, distinct from either old Earth or the outer worlds, something newer and better."
He was parroting Dr. Fastolf, he knew, but it was coming out as though he himself had been thinking of it for years.
Klusar said, "Nuts! Colonize desert worlds with a world of our own at our fingertips? What fools would try?"
"Many. And they wouldn't be fools. There'd be robots to help."
"No!"
said Klusar fiercely.
"Never! No robots!"
"Why not, for the love of heaven? I don't like them either, but I'm not going to knife myself for the sake of a prejudice.
What are we afraid of in robots?
If you want my guess, it's a sense of inferiority. We, all of us, feel inferior to the spacers and hate it. We've got to feel superior somehow, somewhere, to make up for it. And it kills us that we can't at least feel superior to robots. They seem to be better than us, only they're not. That's the damned irony of it."
Bailey felt his blood heating as he spoke.
"Look at this Daniil I've been with for over 2 days. He's taller than I am, stronger, handsomer. He looks like a spacer, in fact. He's got a better memory and knows more facts. He doesn't have to sleep or eat. He's not troubled by sickness or panic or love or guilt. But he's a machine. I can do anything I want to him. The way I can to that microbalance right there. If I slam the microbalance, it won't hit me back. Neither will Daniil. I can order him to take a blaster to himself and he'll do it. We can't ever build a robot that will be even as good as a human being in anything that counts, let alone better.
We can't create a robot with a sense of beauty, or a sense of ethics, or a sense of religion. There's no way we can raise a positronic brain 1 inch above the level of perfect materialism. We can't, damn it, we can't. Not as long as we don't understand what makes our own brains tick. Not as long as things exist that science can't measure. What is beauty, or goodness, or art, or love, or God? We're forever teetering on the brink of the unknowable and trying to understand what can't be understood. It's what makes us men. A robot's brain must be finite, or it can't be built. It must be calculated to the final decimal place so that it has an end. Jehoshaphat, what are you afraid of? A robot can look like Daniil. He can look like a god and be no more human than a lump of wood is. Can't you see that? Klusar had tried to interrupt several times and failed against Bailey's furious torrent. Now, when Bailey paused in sheer emotional exhaustion, he said weakly,
"Copper turned philosopher. What do you know?"
R. Daniil re-entered. Bailey looked at him and frowned, partly with the anger that had not yet left him, partly with new annoyance. He said, "What kept you?" R. Daniil said, "I had trouble in reaching Commissioner Enderby, Elijah. It turned out he was still at his office." Bailey looked at his watch.
"Now? What for?"
"There is a certain confusion at the moment. A corpse has been discovered in the department."
"What? For God's sake, who?"
"The errand boy, R. Sammy." Bailey gagged. He stared at the robot and said in an outraged voice,
"I thought you said a corpse!"
R. Daniil amended smoothly, "A robot with a completely deactivated brain, if you prefer." Klusar laughed suddenly, and Bailey turned on him, saying huskily, "Nothing out of you, understand?" Deliberately, he unlimbered his blaster. Klusar was very silent. Bailey said,
"Well, what of it? Our Sammy blew a fuse. So what?"
"Commissioner Enderby was evasive, Elijah. But while he did not say so outright, my impression is that the commissioner believes our Sammy to have been deliberately deactivated." Then, as Bailey absorbed that silently, R. Daniil added gravely, "Or, if you prefer the phrase, murdered." 16. Questions concerning a motive. Bailey replaced his blaster, but kept his hand unobtrusively upon its butt. He said, "Walk ahead of us, Klusar, to 17th Street, exit B." Klusar said,
"I haven't eaten."
"Tough," said Bailey impatiently. "There's your meal on the floor where you dumped it."
"I have a right to eat."
"You'll eat in detention, or you'll miss a meal. You won't starve. Get going." All three were silent as they threaded the maze of New York East. Klusar moving stonily in advance, Bailey right behind him, and R. Daniil in the rear. It was after Bailey and R. Daniil had checked out at the receptionist's desk, after Klusar had drawn a leave of absence and requested that a man be sent to clean up the balance room, after they were out in the open just to one side of the parked squad car, that Klusar said,
"Just a minute."
He hung back, turned toward R. Daniil, and before Bailey could make a move to stop him, stepped forward and swung his open hand full against the robot's cheek.
"What the devil?"
cried Bailey, snatching violently at Klusar. Klusar did not resist the plainclothes man's grasp.
"It's all right. I'll go. I just wanted to see for myself."
He was grinning. R. Daniil, having faded with the slap, but not having escaped it entirely, gazed quietly at Klusar. There was no reddening of his cheek, no mark of any blow. He said, "That was a dangerous action, Francis. Had I not moved backward, you might easily have damaged your hand. As it is, I regret that I must have caused you pain." Klusar laughed. Bailey said, "Get in, Klusar. You too, Daniil. Right in the back seat with him, and make sure he doesn't move. I don't care if it means breaking his arm. That's an order."
"What about the first law?" mocked Klusar.
"I think Daniil is strong enough and fast enough to stop you without hurting you. But it might do you good to have an arm or two broken at that." Bailey got behind the wheel and the squad car gathered speed.
The empty wind ruffled his hair and Klusar's, but R. Daniil's remained smoothly in place. R. Daniil said quietly to Klusar, "Do you fear robots for the sake of your job, Mr. Klusar?" Bailey could not turn to see Klusar's expression, but he was certain it would be a hard and rigid mirror of detestation, that he would be sitting stiffly apart, as far as he might from R. Daniil. Klusar's voice said,
"And my kids' jobs, and everyone's kids."
"Surely adjustments are possible," said the robot. "If your children, for instance, were to accept training for emigration..." Klusar broke in.
"You two! The policeman talked about emigration. He's got good robot training. Maybe he is a robot."
Bailey growled, "That's enough, you." R. Daniil said evenly, "A training school for emigrants would involve security, guaranteed classification, and assured career. If you are concerned over your children, that is something to consider."
"I wouldn't take anything from a robot or a spacer or any of your trained hyenas in the government."
That was all. The silence of the motorway engulfed them, and there was only the soft whir of the squad car motor and the hiss of its wheels on the pavement. Back at the department, Bailey signed a detention certificate for Klusar and left him in appropriate hands. Following that, he and R. Daniil took the motor spiral up the levels to headquarters. R. Daniil showed no surprise that they had not taken the elevators, nor did Bailey expect him to. He was becoming used to the robot's queer mixture of ability and submissiveness, and tended to leave him out of his calculations. The elevator was the logical method of leaping the vertical gap between detention and headquarters. The long-moving stairway that was the motor spiral was useful only for short climbs, or drops of two or three levels at most. People of all sorts and varieties of administrative occupation stepped on and then off in less than a minute. Only Bailey and R. Daniil remained on continuously, moving upward in a slow and stolid measure. Bailey felt that he needed the time. It was only minutes at best, but up in headquarters he would be thrown violently into another phase of the problem, and he wanted a rest. He wanted time to think and orient himself. Slowly as it moved, the motor spiral went too quickly to satisfy him. R. Daniil said, "It seems, then, we will not be questioning Klusar just yet."
"He'll keep," said Bailey irritably. "Let's find out what the R. Sammy thing is all about."
He added, in a mutter far more to himself than to R. Daniil,
"It can't be independent. There must be a connection."
R. Daniil said, "It is a pity. Klusar's cerebric qualities, what about them? They have changed in a strange way. What was it that took place between the two of you in the balance room while I was not present?" Bailey said absently, "The only thing I did was to preach at him. I passed along the gospel according to St. Fastolf."
"I do not understand you, Elijah."
Bailey sighed and said, "Look, I tried to explain that Earth might as well make use of robots and get its population surplus onto other planets. I tried to knock some of the medievalist hogwash out of his head. God knows why. I've never thought of myself as the missionary type. Anyway, that's all that happened."
"I see.
Well, that makes some sense. Perhaps that can be fitted in. Tell me, Elijah, what did you tell him about robots?"
"You really want to know?"
"I told him robots were simply machines. That was the gospel according to St. Garrigal. There are any number of gospels, I think."
"Did you by any chance tell him that one could strike a robot without fear of a return blow, much as one could strike any other mechanical object?"
"Except a punching bag, I suppose."
"Yes. But what made you guess that?"
Bailey looked curiously at the robot.
"It fits the cerebric changes," said R. Daniil, "and it explains his blow to my face just after we left the factory. He must have been thinking of what you said. So he simultaneously tested your statement, worked off his aggressive feelings, and had the pleasure of seeing me placed in what seemed to him a position of inferiority. In order to be so motivated, and allowing for the delta variations in his quintic..."
He paused a long moment and said, "Yes, it is quite interesting. And now I believe I can form a self-consistent whole of the data." Headquarters level was approaching. Bailey said, "What time is it?" He thought pettishly, "Nuts. I could look at my watch and take less time that way." But he knew why he asked him, nevertheless. The motive was not so different from Klusar's in punching Ardanil. To give the robot a trivial order that he must fulfill emphasized his roboticity, and contrariwise, Bailey's humanity. Bailey thought, "We're all brothers. Under the skin, over it, everywhere. Jehoshaphat." Ardanil said, 2010. They stepped off the motor spiral, and for a few seconds, Bailey had the usual queer sensation that went with the necessary adjustment to non-motion after long minutes of steady movement. He said, "And I haven't eaten. Damn this job anyway." Bailey saw and heard Commissioner Enderby through the open door of his office. The common room was empty, as though it had been wiped clean, and Enderby's voice rang through it with unusual hollowness. His round face looked bare and weak without its glasses, which he had in his hand, while he mopped his smooth forehead with a flimsy paper napkin. His eyes caught Bailey just as the latter reached the door, and his voice rose into a petulant tenor. "Good God, Bailey! Where the devil were you?" Bailey shrugged off the remark and said, "What's doing? Where's the night shift?" And then caught sight of the second person in the office with the commissioner. He said blankly, "Dr. Garrigo." The gray-haired roboticist returned the involuntary greeting by nodding briefly. "I'm glad to see you again, Mr. Bailey." The commissioner readjusted his glasses and stared at Bailey through them. "The entire staff is being questioned downstairs, signing statements. I was going mad trying to find you. It looked queer, your being away." "My being away?" cried Bailey strenuously. "Anybody's being away. Someone in the department did it, and there's going to be hell to pay for that. What an unholy mess. What an unholy, rotten mess." He raised his hands as though in expostulation to heaven, and as he did so, his eyes fell on Ardanil. Bailey thought sardonically, "First time you've looked Daniel in the face. Take a good look, Julius." The commissioner said in a subdued voice, "He'll have to sign a statement. Even I've had to do it. I..." Bailey said, "Look, Commissioner, what makes you so sure that our Sammy didn't blow a gasket all by himself? What makes it deliberate destruction?" The commissioner sat down heavily. "Ask him," he said, and pointed to Dr. Garrigo. Dr. Garrigo cleared his throat. "I scarcely know how to go about this, Mr. Bailey. I take it from your expression that you are surprised to see me." "Moderately," admitted Bailey.